Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is George Werthner. He's the former Ecological Projects Director for the Foundation for Deep Ecology. Currently, he's the Executive Director of Public Lands Media. He's an ecologist and wildlands activist. He's published 38 books on environmental issues and natural history, including such environmentally focused books as Welfare Ranching, Wildfire, Thrillcraft, Energy, and most recently, Protecting the Wild. So first, as always, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
I love talking to you, Derek, so thanks for having me.
Well, it works both ways. So first three questions are, what are allotments? Two, what is restocking allotments? And three, are there any interesting stories happening right now having to do with grazing on public lands in the West?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked those questions. Okay. Little background on to talk about allotments and livestock grazing. Back at the turn of the century, it was the Wild West, and grazing was happening all over what was then, you know, public land, and with no regulation and no restrictions. And ironically, it led to particularly the cattlemen who objected to sheep grazing to ask the federal government to regulate grazing on public lands. And one of the ways that they did this was to get what are called grazing allotments designated. And usually the requirement for a grazing allotment in the West is that you have what's called a base property. Base property is just private land that is near the allotment, and then you would be qualified for a grazing allotment at that time. And the reason the cattlemen were for it was the sheep herders, for the most part in the West, were not based in any particular place. They would spend their summers up in the high mountains grazing on high alpine pastures, and then move their sheep down into desert areas and graze in the great low elevations, sagebrush and places like that across the West. And so they were constantly moving their sheep. And so the cattlemen, who could not be as mobile, basically usually had a ranch as a base. And so by getting grazing allotments put into place, they effectively made it illegal, in a sense, for sheep grazers. Now, of course, over time, some sheep grazers also got base property so they could qualify for an allotment. And this was all formalized in the 1930s with the Taylor Grazing Act. I think it was in 1934 that the act was put into place. And it provided that these allotments would be determined how much grazing could occur and for how long and so forth. And it was based on what was called an animal unit month. I'm getting into the weeds here a little bit, but an AUM was what it took to feed one cow and calf for a month. That's the animal unit month. And so it wasn't based on any particular acreage. In other words, if you were in the desert of Nevada, it might take 200 acres to feed an animal for a month. In, you know, more productive, moist areas, it would be a lot less. And so these allotments were set out, and the federal government charged a fee, which is very minimal. Right now, I think it's $1.35 an AUM, which is, in other words, to graze a cow and calf for a whole month costs you $1.35, and you'd have a hard time feeding a hamster for $1.35 a month. So you can see why ranchers prefer to graze on public lands if they can, because the cost of grazing on private lands is often $15, $20, $25 an AUM, depending upon where we're talking about. So the public lands allotments have become very desirable to ranchers around the West. And one thing I want to really emphasize is that grazing on public lands is a privilege. It is not a right. You'll hear ranchers constantly say, my grazing rights, but they're not rights. They're privileges. One of the things that has contributed, though, to this perception that it's a right is that over time, the federal government has taken the position that if the ranch is sold usually the grazing permits associated with that ranch are transferred to the new base ranch owner. So if I were to buy a ranch from some guy and he had, let's say, grazing allotment that was 100,000 acres or something of public lands, and that would usually get transferred to my base property as part of the deal. And so what's happened as a result of that is that the grazing privileges on public land have become a valuable asset. In other words, if I buy that ranch from the other guy, I have to pay more because he's got a grazing permit on public lands. And banks have even loaned on it in some parts of the West. In other words, if you have a grazing permit, it's seen as such a good deal because it's subsidized public grazing that they will loan on it on the value of those AUMs provided on the grazing allotment. Now, the way that it's supposed to work and the way it seldom works is you're supposed to have what's called a range conservationist, which the short name for it is range con, which my friends and I, who were all biologists and ecologists, et cetera, who worked for the government, we always called them con artists in most cases, because they have a vested interest in keeping cattle or sheep out there. And so they tend to do a couple of things. One, they tend to exaggerate how good the condition of the rangelands are, because if it's in poorer condition, then theoretically they're supposed to reduce the number of cattle out there or change the season of use, et cetera. And they also tend to be, not always, but a lot of people that become range cons are people who just wanted to be a cowboy or own a ranch, but for whatever reason, you know, they weren't married to a rich rancher's daughter or something like that. So the next best thing is to be a range con, because you get to ride around up in the mountains, usually in a pickup truck, but sometimes on a horse, and get to look at the rangelands. Now, because as a range con, you do not want to see the number of cattle and sheep reduced, or at least the use of that area ultimately reduced. In other words, eliminate all grazing. You will do almost anything, go and twist yourself up in a knot trying to keep grazing occurring. So what we will see over and over and over again on public lands is, if there's a problem that even, say, the BLM or the Forest Service acknowledges is a problem, let's say the riparian areas are trash. Riparian areas are the green, thin line of green vegetation along streams, and the water's polluted and the banks are getting trampled down. Most range cons will see that and agree that that's a problem. But their solution would be not to eliminate the livestock, but to put all sorts of publicly subsidized, they're called range improvements, I call them range developments, out there. For example, they might fence a riparian area at public expense to keep cows away from the water. They might put in a pipeline that would suck water from a spring or a river or creek and move it to a water trough away from the creek, so the cattle have less reason to be in the riparian area. And a lot of these, in quote, range developments are very costly, you know, sometimes $1 million or more. And meanwhile, the government might be getting $10,000 in grazing fees. So it's a huge subsidy. In other words, the rancher is paying some money, but it's way below what the real costs of managing that land and trying to protect the public's resource, which is, you know, clean water and the vegetation, the wildlife habitat. And so range developments are put out, and that way you don't have to necessarily reduce livestock grazing, and you can still have your job as a range con. And people think, because they hear, you know, that the range con says this is this and this is, you know, this range is okay, the condition is good, they think that they're hearing the, you know, experience and honest evaluation. And oftentimes, as I said, they have a strong incentive to say things are better than they really are. Plus, when I went to graduate school in range science for a while, and One of the classes I took was range evaluation, where the purpose of it was to train you to determine whether the range was in good condition or was being trashed. And I recall going out, we'd all be looking at the same parcel of land, and then we'd write down on our little notebooks what we felt was the condition of the rangeland. And range is rated basically poor, fair, good, or excellent range condition. And we would get everything from poor to excellent, all looking at the same parcel. And the point of that is a lot of it is really subjective. And when I was in school, we used to call it the art and science of range management. And I used to cynically say, well, you know, there isn't a whole lot of science in it, and it's mostly like art, and art is in the eye of the beholder. And so we have this sort of what happens a lot of times is depending upon what the person wants to say, they can say that the range is in better condition than it really is. Now, there are some scientific ways of evaluating range that less subjective. One is to clip vegetation and weigh it, and dry it and weigh it, and then you get an estimate of how much productivity is there. But that's not done very often because it's very tedious and time consuming, and a lot of range evaluation uses what's called the ocular method. In other words, you just kind of look out and say, yeah, these guys that drive along in their pickup truck and they got their window rolled down. Well, it looks like it's in pretty good shape here. Okay, good condition range. You know, and it's just the guy's opinion or the woman's opinion, and it has nothing to do with the reality out there. And the other thing that happens on grazing allotments that people should be aware of is that a lot of allotments have, you know, especially in the West, there's so much terrain difference. You've got steep mountainsides. You have areas that are far away from water and so forth. And another deceptive method used by range cons is, you know, the area around water, because cattle are drawn to the water and shade, can be really heavily used, and therefore, using layman's terms, trashed by the cattle. But the areas that are far away or up a steep hillside are almost not grazed at all. And what the another deception that'll happen is the range con will average together the condition of the whole allotment. So you can have areas up on a ridgeline that, you know, may see a cow once in every 10 years, averaged in with an area right on the bottom, which is the cows are camped out the whole time there, and then average it together and say, well, the range is generally in pretty good condition, when in fact the important area, the riparian area, which has all the water and it's important for all wildlife, is being negatively impacted. So that's kind of a background on allotments. And there are about, I believe, 22,000, I haven't kept up right to, but around 22,000 permittees in the West. And as in a lot of other situations, you find that there's a lot of what you might call a very small allotments that are, you know, maybe grazed by 100 cattle by a part-time rancher, whereas the vast majority of the forage on public lands is controlled by a very small percentage of ranchers. In fact, a lot of them are corporations, mining companies, etc. For example, J.R. Simplot, who was the wealthiest man in Idaho, he's dead now, but at one time he was the largest permittee in the West. He was a billionaire, and he controlled over 2 million acres of public land to graze cattle on. So what you have is a very small percentage of the permittees control a lot of the public lands allotments. And that's another thing. You can, a way, if you're wealthy like J.R. Simplot, the way you accumulate more allotments is just simply buy up more base properties. So if you've got a lot of money, you can buy, you know, 5 or 10 base properties that all have allotments attached to it, and then collectively have control of a lot of the Western landscape.
I remember one point back in the 90s, I have no idea what it is now, but Budweiser was one of the, like, I don't know, top 20 holders. They were a huge holder. And then there was any number of celebrities. I remember the newscaster Sam Donaldson had a dude ranch, or had a What's Leisure Ranch? What's it called when you are just a rich person who plays at it? And
Well, I call it a sport rancher.
Yeah, and he had one. And the reason I remember that is because he was also pretty adamantly opposed to wolves. And
right.
He's just a rich celebrity who plays around on a ranch, and then he's affecting the local ecology.
Right. I will say, you know, this is one of the ironies, you know, that, you know, there's a lot of sympathy for the, quote, ma and pa rancher. But actually, a lot of the wealthier corporations that own these ranches, or the rich Hollywood guys or whatever, their allotments tend to be in better shape than small-time ranchers, because they can, a number of things, they can afford hired help that will keep, you know, better track of the cattle. They can graze at a lower level. And it's because it's not as important economically, that in fact, a lot of the wealthy corporations and so forth look at it as a tax write-off. So they want to lose money on it. And the end result is that even though there's let's say 90% of the allotments are controlled by small-time ranchers, they often do more damage because they can't put in the time and money to do a better job. But that doesn't mean that even the rich people don't do damage. For example, an heir to the Rockefeller fortune has a ranch in the Centennial Valley of Montana. And relative, and this is a relative thing, relative to the other permittees out there, she does a better job of managing the cattle on her allotment, because she can afford to hire, you know, range riders are people who ride around and keep the cattle out of the riparian areas or try to keep predators away, etc. But she still, you know, there's all sorts of impacts from livestock raising that you cannot avoid. Anybody who says livestock raising is sustainable, especially in public lands, is not thinking about the full accounting of costs. So, for example, on her property, there's fences all over. Well, fences, sage grouse, which are found there, regularly collide with fences and die. And sage grouse are an endangered species that have been petitioned to be listed on the Endangered Species Act. And in some studies, they find as much as almost as 30% of the mortality is from collisions with fences. She also, there are pronghorn antelope out there, and pronghorn antelope won't jump over fences. So they may be chased by a coyote, for example, trying to get away, but they won't go over the fence, and the predator, you know, corrals them against the fence. Birds of prey will sit on fence posts out in middle of sagebrush where there would normally be no place for a bird of prey to sit, and prey on things like sage grouse. The cattle that she runs do still poop on the ground, and in the concentration and numbers that are out there, they pollute water. Every study I've ever seen that took E. coli samples in streams which were being actively grazed always have exceeded the state standards for what's an acceptable level of E. coli. Your cattle, in particular, socially displace other animals like elk. In other words, if there's cattle grazing in an area, the elk avoid it. And if one presumes that the elk would prefer to be there because it's better habitat, then you're impacting the elk's overall fitness. You have the effects that cattle hooves break up biocrust, the algae and lichens on the ground that prevents things like cheatgrass from getting established. You have the effect that the cattle are eating the forage that would otherwise support native animals like elk or pronghorn. So I'm just going through. There's many more impacts I can mention. But the idea is, even a permittee who does a better job of managing their cattle than other permittees, because they have the money to do it, is still having huge impacts on the public resources. And you know, especially when there's somebody like a Rockefeller heir, you start to say, well, why does this person have to graze on public lands at all? And this particular permittee,
you know, was got all sorts of credit from Audubon and Sierra Club and other Greater Yellowstone Coalition for putting in water developments away from the creeks to protect the riparian areas. But this person got over $1 million from the federal government to put in the water developments, which is still taking water from the creeks too, by the way. So, you know, here's a multi-millionaire, billionaire, well, I don't know how much money she has, but she has a lot, taking federal dollars to reduce the impact of her cattle, and then gets all this praise from these environmental groups instead of saying, you know, what the heck? Why is she taking federal money, and why is she even grazing in the first place? So that's one of the problems with the allotment system, is that they're controlled, a lot of it's controlled by the larger landowners and people that have quite a bit of wealth, that you just wonder, why are they grazing at all? And the only thing I can think of is that they actually want to lose money and, you know, improve their tax affairs by claiming a loss, business loss.
Excuse me. A couple of things. One of them is, when you were talking about the range cons, it reminded me of foresters who will do the exact same thing on USFS and BLM lands, where the place can be completely trashed. And it's like, no, we can get more timber out of there. And I've mentioned this before, that I really like the local national forest, the local district. And they do lots of good things. And one of the reasons they do a lot of good things is because they don't have a timber sale program. And I don't think they have a grazing program. And if the grazing if they do have a grazing program, it's really small. So what this means is they use the federal money for things like removing old mining roads and doing what one would want caretakers of public land to do. My point is it's just extraordinary to me how much it destroys the entire district as soon as you put in an extraction model.
Exactly. And here's one more thing about allotments that people should be aware of. When I'm talking about things, like an example would be, let's say you have a campground, you're on Forest Service land, you have a campground, and they want to fence it so that they don't have cattle wandering through people's tents and pooping all over, right? You would think that that would come out of the range budget, but instead it would come out of the recreation budget. But there would be no need to fence the campground if it wasn't for the cattle there. Another example of this was on BLM lands down in Arizona that I saw, where they, because of the cattle grazing in the riparian area, there was almost no regeneration of cottonwoods, which are very valuable for a lot of wildlife. So they actually planted cottonwoods and fenced them off, and then put in drip irrigation systems. And all that came out of the wildlife fund rather than the range fund. So, you know, there's a whole lot of this sort of ways that they minimize how much the in other words, if you were to add up all these other costs that other departments, you might say, or divisions within the federal agency absorb, the losses to grazing would be even higher, and the subsidies would be even higher, because oftentimes they're able to get some other area to pay for to protect our lands from private livestock. And it's pretty much an outrage that this occurs to this day. When you look at all the costs that I mentioned before, none of those costs are ever considered when they decide whether grazing is profitable or not. So when the BLM or the Forest Service said, they'll even admit they lose money every year anyway. But if they were to actually figure, you know, how much does it cost the taxpayer to try to bring back the survival of endangered species, trout, sage grouse, et cetera, that are negatively impacted by cattle grazing, if that cost were added in, you'd have a higher cost. If you added in what the costs were for fencing all the campgrounds and highway right-of-ways and so forth, then that would reduce the profitability even more. So the losses, the economic losses are terrific, and they're never internalized. And of course, the ranchers will fight the internalization of those costs, and so do the range cons. And the irony with a lot of these allotments, of course, is that the ultimate decision about whether to graze or not and how much and how long is made by the range con. So you might think there's a they might consult with a wildlife biologist or a fishery biologist, but all they can do is make recommendations. They don't make the ultimate decision. So that let's say, like in Wyoming, a good example of one area was the Upper Green River allotment, which is near Pinedale, Wyoming. Dozens and dozens of grizzly bears have been killed on that allotment. But that's not considered in the cost of grazing that public land there. They just agreed to another extension of the grazing there in that allotment. And the Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that up to 74 grizzly bears may be killed in the next, I think it's 10 to 15 years on that allotment to protect the private cattle that are grazing on our lands. I mean, to me, this is absurd that this even goes on, when the simplest way to protect grizzly bears and a whole lot of other species that are on that allotment is just simply eliminate the livestock grazing. But that is not the way it goes. Livestock has the priority on the public lands.
That would be a nice transition to talk about Point Reyes, but there's actually something else I want to go back to that you said. I grew up in Colorado, and so cottonwoods are a, I don't know what the word is, they are a totem, they take me back to my childhood. And you said cottonwoods mm-hmm. are really important for wildlife, and like I said, I love yep. cottonwoods and grew up around them. But I have no idea what you're talking about. Can you give us a 1 minute lecture on how cottonwoods are good for wildlife?
Oh, there are all sorts of ways. One, you have a lot of birds will nest in cottonwoods, everything from great blue heron, to eagles, etc. You have a lot of cavity nesters because it's kind of soft wood. So, things like you might find bluebirds nesting in it in a cavity. There's all kinds of, insects that are found on cottonwood trees. So warblers go through cottonwood during their migration, and they're in the cottonwood trees feeding on insects. When the cottonwood fall into a river, that provides habitat for fish and aquatic insects, which means that there's more everything associated with a stream because of those aquatic insects, including more bats over the streams and birds. And in fact, in the Southwest, just thought of bats, there's an endangered bat called the red bat, which nests on the flaky bark that's falling off of dead cottonwood trees, and that's one of their major habitats. And elk and deer, too, like to eat cottonwood, young cottonwood, that is. And so there's just a lot of wildlife that depends on cottonwood.
Thank you.
But before I go to,
go ahead.
I wanted to get to this stocking issue too that we were going to talk about. So throughout the West, there are grazing allotments that are called vacant allotments. In other words, they're still there in theory on some map somewhere in a Forest Service or a BLM office, but they haven't been grazed in a long time, and so they're considered vacant. And they can be vacant because the rancher, for example, sold his ranch and somebody bought it and decided they just don't want to bother with that allotment. In other words, maybe they have to move their cattle or sheep a long ways to get to it, and it's just not worth it. And nobody else is interested in it. So it's vacant. Also, the other way that we get vacant allotments is in recent years, there's been what's called a permit, grazing allotment permit buyout, where private funds are raised to go to some rancher and say, we will pay you X amount of dollars if you will volunteer to give up your grazing privileges on the public land. And in theory, the Forest Service of the BLM agrees to honor that transition and not restock that allotment that's vacant now with other cattle or sheep. And what's been happening, and I think it was instituted by the Trump administration, but it still continues under Biden so far, has been to find vacant allotments, and the BLM and the Forest Service have been told to try to restock them. In other words, make them available for cattle grazing or sheep grazing. And in some cases, like I said, maybe hundreds of thousands of dollars have been paid to some rancher to give up their grazing privileges. And now the government is talking about putting more livestock on there. And sometimes it's a kind of a shady, way of sort of avoiding the agreement. So there's some grazing allotments also on the Upper Green that in Wyoming that were sheep allotments where various private entities, including like the National Wildlife Foundation, the Sagebrush Fund, and other groups have purchased the grazing privileges, so to speak. They paid the rancher to give up their allotment privileges. And in this case, in the Upper Green, because it used to be sheep, the Forest Service is now saying, well, we only agreed not to allow sheep grazing anymore, so we're going to allow cattle grazing now. And, you know, so this is the kind of, because it's not a legal, there's no legal binding thing with most of these grazing permit buyouts. Now, there have been a few that are permanent because it's part of legislation. So, for example, the Boulder White Cloud Wilderness in Idaho, which was designated, I don't know how many years ago, 7, 8, 10 years ago, whenever it was, had specific language in the legislation creating that wilderness that said that the grazing allotments in and around that wilderness could be retired only voluntarily with private money only, no government money, but could never be grazed again. And because that was a legislative decision, that's permanent, unless, of course, Congress changes the legislation. But there are very few of those kinds of agreements out there. So you're always subject to having the area regrazed. For example, the Grand Canyon Trust bought some base property in northern Arizona. I think the ranch was only like 1,000 acres, but it controlled hundreds of thousands of acres of grazing privileges. And their intention was to get rid of all the livestock. Well, the Forest Service said, well, if you don't graze it, we're going to give those grazing privileges to somebody else. So the Grand Canyon Trust had to start grazing livestock, even though their whole purpose was to eliminate livestock grazing. So this is the kind of thing that goes on. And right now there's a proposal to, there are 6 vacant allotments just south of Livingston, Montana, that are really valuable for wildlife. And just north of Yellowstone Park, you know, and there's grizzlies, there's wolves, there's bison, elk, etc. And the Forest Service is talking about restocking all 6 vacant allotments. And the district ranger was able to keep 2 of them closed because most of them are in wilderness areas, using that excuse, but he was still forced to, you know, agree to open up the others. Same thing is happening on the Tioga Humboldt National Forest down in Nevada. A number of wilderness areas there have vacant grazing allotments on them that are Forest Service is trying to open up. And in Wyoming, same thing's going on there on the Upper Green, as I mentioned, some other parts of the Bridger-Teton National Forest, and I believe that down in Grand Staircase Escalante, some vacant allotments there. BLM is talking about, I don't think they've done it yet, but restocking allotments that had been closed. So we're seeing this all over the West. And of course, it's so heartbreaking when you've gone through all this trouble to eliminate livestock grazing and paid a lot of money to eliminate it. And then the federal government turns around, and mostly because the Rings Con want to increase their job security, put livestock back on these allotments.
We've seen the same thing too with some people or some organizations attempting to buy timber sales that the Forest Service is going to put out and then not cut. And the Forest Service would say, no, you can't buy it unless you cut it. And I don't want to get too philosophical here, but I do want to say that precisely this issue of selling, of not being able to buy a timber sale and leave the trees standing, and also these restocking allotments, is one of the things that convinced me that this culture as a whole really wants to destroy nature.
Well,
because none of this makes any economic sense.
Yeah, I'd say the whole culture.
We don't really need to go there.
But the foresters and the range cons definitely have a financial vested interest in continuing the resource exploitation. And so do agencies like the Forest Service, because a lot of their budget is dependent upon, you know, cutting trees. And the BLM, a lot of its budget is dependent on grazing livestock. So, you know, that makes these incentives out there that are not good for the land or for the public.
So I know you've said this, but I want to just come back and talk about the fundamental unfairness. Let's just leave wildlife out of it for a second. The fundamental unfairness of you raise, so I'm a rancher, and you raise, you know, $1 million to make it so I won't graze this land anymore, $100,000, however much it is you raise. And then we have a deal, and then it ends up that the money you gave me was what ended up being a waste, because they're just going to restock it. That's as well as everything else, it's fundamentally unfair.
It is, and but let me
explain. Oh, wait. There's
the
one more
strategy.
Thing.
Yeah.
There's one more thing, okay. I want to say, which is, so many times I have heard the argument made that the reason that the Forest Service and BLM have to continue these is because there's this long tradition, and it would basically be takings to take away their rights, quote, end quote. And when you have one that's not stocked, it seems the problem has been solved for you, this problem of long tradition. And so it seems the problem has been solved, so why do you make a new problem? Anyway, sorry, go ahead.
Well, you're right on all that, and I'll tell you why you make the new problem. Because this idea of grazing permit retirement was actually becoming more and more popular, because a lot of ranchers are retirement age, and they can get a, as Andy Kerr says, a golden parachute that lets them retire with a lot of money. That, you know, we don't owe them a cent. It's public land. We can terminate these grazing permits anytime we want, but course, it seldom happens. So, you know, the rancher gets a couple $100,000 to give up his grazing privileges. It's pretty attractive, especially if you're not planning to continue ranching. But that means that the agency now has that much less land that they're going to, quote, manage, particularly if you're a range con. So I don't know the motivation behind all this, but part of me suspects that by restocking vacant allotments, especially where there was grazing permit retirement, you're going to make it a lot harder to raise private funds to do any future grazing permit retirements. Because who wants to donate $100,000 to retire a grazing allotment permit when you don't know that it's permanent? So this might be a sort of a way to sabotage the whole voluntarily grazing permit buyout idea.
So let's, before we turned on the recorder, you mentioned Point Reyes as an example of some of the harm of these allotments. Can you talk about Point Reyes for a minute? And like, what is Point Reyes? For people who don't know, what is Point Reyes? And then what's the controversy?
Yeah. Point Reyes is just north of San Francisco. It's a national seashore, which means it's a unit of the National Park Service. So it's like a national park. It was created in 1962, again, with public tax dollars. The whole peninsula was once grazed by ranchers and farmers. And it was sort of isolated just north of San Francisco, but there was a real fear that some of it would start being developed into housing tracts and so forth. So the solution was to try to buy out these ranchers and then, make it a national park unit. And we spent really hundreds of millions of dollars buying up these ranches out there. And as a generous, you might say, element of the buyout, the ranchers were allowed, if they wanted to retain their houses and barns and other fixtures and graze for an additional 25 years after they were paid for their land and buildings. And then they were supposed to be gone. But what happened was, as soon as those 25 years were up, the ranchers political pressure got the Park Service to give them another extension. I believe it was 20 years. And this has happened a number of times now. And meanwhile, the dairy farming and the beef farming that is occurring out there is having lots of impacts on the attributes of the national park. For example, one of the most polluted coastal streams in all of California flows out of the national park because of the cattle grazing along the waterway. There also is the Point Reyes National Seashore is the only national park unit that has tule elk, which is a endangered subspecies of elk only found in California. And they're actually fenced in so that they can't interfere with the private dairy and beef farming that's occurring on our lands. And another thing that's particularly galling is these ranch families are living in the homes, you know, that we own. And they pay hardly anything for that privilege, not to mention pay hardly anything for the grazing there either on the public lands. So the Park Service loses hundreds of thousands of dollars on just administering the grazing privileges. I believe it's about a third of the park is grazed by livestock. And a couple of years ago, there was a drought occurring and where the elk grazed, the water, fresh water supplies dried up and hundreds of elk died just from thirst out there. But they wouldn't let them leave the fenced in area because then they'd be on the lands that the ranchers are utilizing, our lands again. And Point Reyes has almost 100 endangered species. It's very unique landscape with a lot of what they call coastal prairie mixed with various native forests like Bishop Pine and so forth and Douglas fir. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. So anyway, as a result of this elk die-off and some other factors, the National Park Service was sued by environmental groups like the Center for Biodiversity, Western Watersheds Project, and the Resource Renewal Institute, I believe that's their name, to say that they needed to terminate the livestock grazing there. And the Park Service came out with a plan that they just made their decision on, released it about a week ago, that not only maintains all the ranching for another 20 years, but expands the area that will be grazed. And it allows the ranchers to start growing row crops, which means, you know, plowing up the landscape and other concessions to the livestock industry. And the interesting thing, there's 24 ranchers that control grazing on Point Reyes and nearby. They also graze some acreage on Golden Gate National Recreation Area as well. And the irony here is that this is championed by Senator Dianne Feinstein and Congressman Huffman, both of who are liberal Democrats, who have come out saying that the Park Service should continue to allow these ranching operations to occur on the public's land there, which, as I said, they were paid hundreds of millions of dollars for back in the 60s. And some of the ranchers that were there went and bought, you know, other grazing land in other places. And but some of them stayed. And the irony is a lot of their support comes from real liberal, typically liberal, politically liberal people in the Bay Area who are arguing that we need to have local food production. Of course, that ignores that there's lots of other land in Marin and Sonoma counties that's open to agriculture. In fact, that's the dominant land use in both of those counties. And there are 5 million cattle in all of California. I mean, there's no shortage of cattle in the rest of the state. You don't need to be grazing a national park unit. And so anyway, that's where it stands right now. I don't have a lot of hopes that it's going to be reversed, but I suspect there'll be further lawsuits on this, hopefully to try to reverse the Park Service decision. And you know, I just, you almost begs credibility. The Park Service in their EIS said that even though there's impacts to water, to the land, to wildlife, that they have to keep grazing because if they don't have cattle there, a bunch of rare species that depend on disturbance will disappear. And you have to say, okay, well, how did those rare species survive all these thousands of years without cattle there? I mean, you know, it's this argument that you have to have, you know, constant manipulation from livestock to save species that have been around for thousands of years anyway. And it's obviously just sort of trying, you know, grasping straws to justify the continued ranching operations there.
That reminds me of an argument that's used by the Forest Service to deforest, which is that they want to improve habitat for white-tailed deer. And
right.
Never mind that there's white-tailed deer all over the place, but also white-tailed right. deer like the edges of clear cuts. They like the edge between a right. forest and a meadow or a forest and open. And it's just insane to claim that you're helping wildlife by harming the land.
That's right. And yet that's what they're doing. And that's the excuse they gave. And it's, you know, it's also disappointing that the political people like Huffman and Feinstein support this too. I mean, it is a national park unit, and it's not like BLM and Forest Service, which have a mandate to accommodate more extractive industry. Usually we try to think of our national parks as, and in fact, the mandate that created the national park said that you will have to manage Point Reyes to, you know, enhance and protect the natural features. I'm just sort of paraphrasing here, but, and obviously the cattle grazing isn't doing that. And it's got to be, somebody should be able to, I hope, take them to court and argue that they are not even following the original mandate that created the national park unit.
And are you suggesting that plowing up grassland is not enhancing natural features?
That's what I'm insinuating, or polluting the stream. So it's the most polluted stream on the entire California coast is not doing good things for the native species either.
So we only have a couple minutes left. I know that we sort of always end this way, but what do you want people to do with this information?
Well, I hope that they will pay attention to grazing on public lands, because I think it's one of the biggest impacts on our public lands. We graze hundreds of millions of acres of land to the detriment of wildlife, soil, water, etc. And yet most people just ignore the impacts from livestock. You know, it's easy to see the impacts from a clear cut, for example. So, you know, naturally people are more focused on those things. Whereas, you know, the cattle are out there clear cutting the grasslands in much the same way. And having even more impacts than the logging does. And really, our public lands, you know, I mean, this is my philosophy in general. All public lands, I think, should be managed for their natural features, because the private lands, we can't control that, unfortunately. And private lands dominate in this country. Only a third of the country is public lands. It isn't asking too much to set aside those lands for nature. And natural processes and ecosystem protection.
So back in the 90s, there was a movement for zero cut on public land, which unfortunately has not gained a lot of traction. Are there some organizations you can recommend who are advocating for zero cattle on public lands in the West?
You know, I don't know if any of these organizations would say that that's their goal, but they would certainly say their goal is to reduce significantly livestock on public lands. And of those organizations, there's the Western Watersheds Project, whose main mission deals only with livestock production. So that's their total focus. And a couple other organizations have livestock grazing as an important part of their agenda, which is the Center for Biodiversity and Wild Earth Guardians is another group. And then there's some smaller regional groups that address these things, like the Alliance for the Wild Rockies in Montana, and the Oregon Natural Desert Association in Oregon. And, you know, there are a few other groups like that that you'd call regional that do deal with livestock grazing as well. But the first three I mentioned, Western Watersheds Project, Center for Biodiversity, and Wild Earth Guardians, are the only groups west-wide that I'm aware of that are dealing with this on all the time. And then you have groups like Sierra Club, which does do some work related to it, but it seems to be subservient to other issues in a lot of cases.
Well, thank you. Is there anything else you want to say about this before we go?
No, just that, you know, in my view, livestock production is one of the biggest impacts in the world. You know, it's one of the biggest emitters of carbon through methane production. We use a lot of the grain produced in the world to feed livestock. And then even when they're not being fed grain and they're just feeding on grass, they're having impacts on all kinds of wildlife. So in an individual way, probably one of the few things where people can really, you know, have an impact on global environmental things is the decision of not to eat livestock, beef and sheep, and try to eliminate that or at least reduce it in your diet. And if enough people did that, we'd be a whole lot better off.
Well, thank you for your work in the world, and thank you for being on the program. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been George Werthner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.